This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Well, if you weren't already a little bit crazy, you have no business running Fordham.
That was very self-aware of you, Sam.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, the original Education Gadfly, Checker Finn.
Yes, sir.
Hello, Checker. Welcome back. Always joining me, as always, David Griffith.
Hey, Mike. Good to be here.
Yes. I think I just said always joining me, as always. Boy, I think I am still waking up, you know, because Memorial Day weekend. I hope you guys enjoy your kickoff to the summer celebrations.
I'm thoroughly kicked.
There you go. I will say, Checker, we discussed on the show last week, we've been obsessed with the cicadas and how they are sort of the original education gadfly in a way.
Boy, I'll say, Rainer and I took a walk yesterday, and when we got out of the enclosure where our apartment building is, it got like a jet plane.
Yeah. My dog is going nuts. I'm actually starting to wonder if it's driving me a little bit crazy. I'm having a hard time focusing, and I'm going to blame the cicadas.
Well, if you weren't already a little bit crazy, you have no business running Fordham.
Thank you. That's right. That was very self-aware of you to say that, Checker. All right. Well, there's a bit of a crazy debate going on at the National Assessment Governing Board over the NAEP reading test. We're going to talk all about that in Ed Reform Update. All right, Checker. Well, you know, you were the first chair of NAGB, the National Assessment Governing Board, way back when. And I'm not sure if we've told our listeners you are working on a book about NAEP and the future of NAEP. So you've been tracking these things closely, and it turns up there's a bit of a kerfuffle happening right now over reading. Can you tell us a little bit about it and help us understand what's going on?
First, our listeners need to keep in mind that the National Assessment Governing Board, known to its friends as NAGB, is 26 members. You know, it's a little bit of a Noah's Ark. Two governors, two chief state school officers, two local superintendents, three teachers, three principals, et cetera, et cetera. Currently chaired by former Mississippi Governor Haley Barbour. And it's been around for 30 years. I was indeed its first chair and was a member of it for its first 8 years, actually. It sets the parameters for what NAEP is going to test and how it's going to test it, what's going to be on those tests. The basis for that, as for many tests, including state assessments, is you have to have a framework that says, what do you think the kids ought to know? And then you can build test questions off that. And that's what NAEP does. The reading framework goes back to 2009, but actually the trend line that in reading goes back to, I believe, 1992. So we've got about almost 30 years of unbroken trend data in NAEP for reading. And this is a pretty important metric for American education in terms of knowing what's going up or down or staying flat. But every 15 or so years, the board takes a fresh look at its frameworks for the now 10 subjects that NAEP assesses. And they got into reading starting a couple years ago, and this produced a huge kerfuffle within the board because the draft new framework that one of the board's committees came up with a whole bunch of outside advisors and experts and so forth, was not appealing to a bunch of other members of the board. And the political issue here is that one of NAEP's great assets over all these decades has been the ability of this Noah's Ark board to reach a reasonable consensus about stuff and not behave like the Congress behaves, not behave like the Texas legislature just behaved over the weekend. In other words, get together about big, important decisions. If it has a big schism over how to test reading, this is a real issue for the credibility of NAEP going forward, I think, as well as for how we understand reading in the country. So what is the schism about? It's about two big things. One is reading itself fundamentally a sociocultural activity, as the committee initially presented it to the board, or is it fundamentally something grounded in reading science? Secondly, to what extent, if any, does prior knowledge on the part of kids factor into their reading comprehension? And should it be eradicated, eliminated, minimized? And if kids don't possess the relevant knowledge and vocabulary when they start the reading test, should they be given various forms of help within the test? Little definitions, little videos, little things they can click on to supply the knowledge that they don't already possess. And there's a huge ruckus in the reading field here over reading comprehension and whether prior background knowledge is essential or is an impediment to the proper testing of reading comprehension. Anyway, the committee came in with a sociocultural framework that was going to supply a bunch of supports to kids with respect to background knowledge. And a bunch of board members didn't like that. So they went through a round of revisions and a bunch of outside review commentary. A lot of people still didn't like the revision. One member of the board, a former director of the Institute for Education Sciences himself, did a one-man rewrite and was practically canceled out of the board by the committee that came up with the controversial draft in the first place. So all this is very much in flux right at the moment. It is not clear to me where this is going to come out, and it's meant to affect the 2026 reading assessment and all reading assessments after that. It's very much up in the air right at this moment.
You would think of all the subjects that reading maybe what would be the easiest, right? I mean, at least if you ask sort of regular people on the street, you know, what does it mean to be a good reader? I don't know. I think most people could come up with a pretty easy answer. But I guess when you get into the world of academia and the folks who study this, and certainly when you look at achievement gaps, right? I mean, that's the background here, is this question about why is it that we've got these big achievement gaps by race or by income? And is it because of the way we're defining reading? If we defined it differently, then maybe some of those gaps would disappear. I assume that's part of it.
My own issue, and that of a lot of other critics like David Steiner, for example, is that in the real world, you don't get supports. You don't get little things that pop up and tell you the meaning of a word in the real world. So why should you get it when you're being assessed on your reading comprehension if that gives an unrealistic picture of your reading capability?
I mean, that seems to be a starting point. Can you pick up a newspaper? Maybe it's not the New York Times, or maybe it's at least USA Today. And can you understand what the articles are about? What's wrong with that? That just seems pretty straightforward.
But yes, seems that way to me.
Yeah, but it is, you know, and this is getting caught up in some of these, of course, larger battles, culture wars over race and racism and all the rest. David, what's your take on this?
Well, there's a couple of fundamental problems here, or confounds, right? One is that we talk about reading like it's a single thing, whereas it's a whole bundle of different skills. And you could probably make the case for separating decoding from background knowledge. And really, once you're getting into background knowledge, why not just assess social studies, right? And the various things that you're drawing upon, rather than pretending like you're assessing reading. But if the point of reading comprehension is to ask, can you navigate society basically as it exists today, then I don't see much of a counterargument. It's a fact that American society is organized around standard English, and that advantages certain people and it disadvantages other people. But the fact that it advantages or disadvantages some groups does not change the reality. And so I don't know if there's a way to articulate that that hasn't been tried. I also suspect that, you know, I mean, English is like every language. It's evolving. It looks a little different today than it did 30 or 40 years ago. And so, you know, maybe eventually we'll get to a place as a country where this is less of an issue. I guess I just think we're not there yet. And I would encourage people who see this as a means to an end to turn it around and ask whether we could get there more quickly by ensuring that everyone speaks standard English.
Well, and look, to the extent that all of the sides in this debate agree that reading comprehension is very closely related to background knowledge, then fantastic. I feel like E.D. Hirsch has won, right? I mean, that's the argument he's made for 30 years, that because of that, we need to do a better job teaching background knowledge. Now, I know this board is focused on assessments, okay, but let's have the rest of the field focus on this insight, which says, of course, we got to get the decoding part right and the other pieces of early reading and scientifically based reading instruction. And then we got to get serious about teaching background knowledge via history and geography and science and all the rest. All right, Checker. So is this going to have a happy ending?
I'm told there's an effort at a compromise version of this underway in the works, but I don't know what it's going to look like or whether it's going to please the contending parties at this time. If it doesn't, if we can't get to a version of the reading framework that everybody can say, I can live with that, then we, I guess they keep the current framework for longer, which I don't think is a terrible thing. The question is, what's the next team at NAGB going to do when they take up the revision of the reading framework? And is it, are they going to come up with something even more preposterous than the committee that came up with the draft that is controversial today? So I'm not sure where this goes, even if the current effort sort of washes out and they are stuck with the current framework for a while longer, which in the short run is fine with me. In the long run, yeah, you can't keep one of these frameworks around forever.
All right. Thank you, Trekker. Hope they do figure this out. If they do, maybe we'll have you back on to discuss
that. Any old time.
All right. Thanks again, Trekker Finn, the original Education Gadfly, President Emeritus at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. It is now time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Hope you had a nice Memorial Day weekend.
I did. Got some rain, but the grass needed it, so not going to complain about that.
Yes, indeed. You know, listen to really an amazing NPR story the other day. We'll do a quiz. You often quiz us, Amber.
No, I'm scared.
What percentage of Americans are in the military? I think either in or have been in the military.
Well, that makes it a difference.
Maybe it's just in the military. What percent?
Oh, no. A quarter.
1%.
That's it?
You didn't let me guess.
1%. Oh, sorry, David. You want to guess now?
1%.
Very good. David nailed it.
That's what I would have said, though.
It's just tiny.
Wow. Because we all know somebody who's been in the military, so we think it's higher, you know?
Well, it's interesting. No, there's even a lot of people that don't know that. And like, I got to say, like, I guess it was my grandparents' generation. There were men who served, but...
This is recently, this have ever been?
No, I think it must be currently in the military.
Yeah, okay. Well, we fact-checked this one rigorously, as usual, right?
All right, well, this is what happens when I just, like, hear an NPR story and then bring it to our listeners. Sorry about that, folks. I'll work harder next time. But it is remarkable, you know, from a country that used to, where it used to be, just, you know, there was a draft, and this was extremely common, and now not so much, and that there's big chunks of the country where very few young men and women serve.
Well, partly it's harder to get in the military, too, from what I gather anecdotally, you know?
It is, and some huge percentage don't qualify, right? Either because for academic reasons or because of obesity or other health issues.
These numbers are less surprising to the Portland boy. I'll just leave it at that.
Yes, I can imagine. But I always think about, you know, when we think about K-12 education and where kids are going next, that, you know, we talk about college and career. Sometimes we now remember to talk about citizenship. Military service. I mean, so many reasons to think on the whole can be a very positive experience.
Yes, absolutely.
Some cool stuff. All right. Enough with that. I will do better next time, folks. I'm listening with my full attention and fact checking before I bring it here. What you got for us this week, Amber?
We have a new study, always do, in educational policy this week. It examines how state alternative certification, or AC, policies impacted the composition of beginning teachers. These policies, I think most of our listeners know, they've historically been pretty controversial. Some folks basically think they have low recruitment standards, for which there's evidence of that. And other people think they've got higher recruitment standards, and there's evidence of that too. So this study uses five waves of federal data from the Schools and Staffing Survey, starting in 1993 and ending in 2012. They also use one wave from the National Teacher and Principal Survey, which I think is the new name, which covers 2015-2016. These data include information on teacher demographics, educational background, teaching assignments, and a bunch of other stuff. This study hones in on the first-year teachers, has a sample of roughly 9,700 of those new teachers. State-level variables of interest report how the adoption of or changes to AC policies affected the fraction of new teachers to graduate from highly competitive institutions, the average SAT scores of those institutions, the fraction of new teachers of color, the fraction of male teachers, and the fraction of new in-demand teachers, meaning those who are teaching math, science, special education, or English as a second language. So looking at all that stuff, they use a difference in differences design. that basically compares the characteristics of beginning teachers in states before and after the adoption of or changes to these AC policies. They got a fixed effects model, controls for a number of variables, state overall population, fraction of people of color, fraction of bachelor degree holders, unemployment rate, per capita income, student enrollment, and other stuff. Unfortunately, and this was one sentence, it's kind of an important one. Due to small incisions, the design, although it accounts for unobserved but fixed state level differences, it cannot rule out that these observed differences are explained by pre-existing trends. So we don't know whether some of these results might be caused by those trends before these policies. Results, I've got some descriptive results and then I've got the diff and diff results. Descriptively, a smaller fraction of traditionally prepared teachers graduated from a competitive institution compared to the AC teachers, and the average SAT and ACT scores of the AC teacher institutions was 13.5 points higher than those of traditionally prepared teachers. Black teachers and those of other races and ethnicities were also more likely to enter teaching through AC programs. Now for the diff and diff results, states had a greater fraction of teachers who both graduated from highly competitive and less competitive colleges. So we see some bifurcation there compared to before adopting these policies. Specifically, there was a 6.1 percentage point increase in the fraction of new teachers coming from competitive colleges, which was actually driven by, quote, highly and very competitive colleges, according to this Barron's Index, and comparatively lower, 3.7 percentage point increase in the fraction of new teachers graduating from less competitive institutions. So that's the next to the last ranking. So they got the 6-point scale of competitiveness, which was a little confusing to me at first. So you're seeing this sort of bifurcation of the very highly and very competitive colleges and at the almost the lowest rung of competitiveness, although it's in favor of the highly and very competitive colleges, the bifurcation. All right. The policy was also associated with an 8.4 percentage point increase in the fraction of new teachers of color in a state, which was what the headline was. More specifically, there was a 1.8 percentage point increase in Black teachers in a state, and a 6.2 percentage point increase in other races, which were all combined. There was no relationship found relative to the share of male teachers or teachers of in-demand subjects, those other outcomes they were looking at. And then they try to look to see whether the changes in these new teacher characteristics was driven by the presence of TFA in a state, because I think some people would wonder about that. Since TFA is such a large AC program, they find that the presence of TFA does not change their estimates, but in my opinion, it was also a pretty rough measure. It wasn't clear to me that they had a measure of penetration versus just presence. Then they dig into the role of increasing academic standards for admissions into AC programs and find that higher standards, I think that meant higher ACT and SAT scores, results in a 4.4 percentage point increase in new teachers from competitive colleges and in-demand teachers in STEM. And then they closed with a pretty, I thought, good discussion of the pros and cons of these programs. One of the greatest pros, in my opinion, is that AC teachers typically earn a salary during their probationary period while working toward their license versus traditionally university-based programs typically don't allow that. And the con is that AC teachers tend to exit at greater rates.
So the policy is simply allowing alternative certification programs?
So adopting them or making changes to them, they clump those things together.
Yeah, look, this all makes a lot of sense to me, especially the bifurcation. Like, it makes me wonder if maybe some of the big state schools that produce a lot of teachers, maybe those are kind of in the middle of the competitiveness ranking. I would certainly believe that, right? And so you get these high-end teachers that, again, are maybe the Teach for America types or some of these other teaching fellow programs that tend to go for those highly selective colleges. And then you're also opening the door to some schools that maybe aren't as competitive, but are where a lot of first-generation students end up going and that are more diverse. And look, I certainly remember the vicious debates that we used to have back in the 90s about these programs, certainly about Teach for America, Linda Darling Hammond trying to kill off Teach for America and coming very close to it. And look, just look, kind of like charter schools, I mean, here we are, have some sort of uneven piece. I mean, these things aren't going away, right? And they're also not going to replace traditional teacher prep, right? You just got both. And they probably each appeal to different types of young people. And now the goal is let's make them both as effective as possible. And but look, I think at a time when everybody is focused on teacher diversity, it's clear these are a big part of the puzzle. And you think about what could traditional programs maybe do to be more appealing to the diverse teachers. I mean, even if it's doing a better job, for example, communicating the loan forgiveness programs that are out there, helping young people say, hey, look, come to our ed school, become a teacher, teach for 5 years in an inner city school, and much of your student loan debt is going to go away. You know, that might be attractive in the same way as being the alternative programs, being able to say, hey, you earn a salary from day one.
Right.
And was that the takeaway, Amber? Was the, you know, was that their sort of positive explanation was that it's just basically cost?
No, that was a pretty nuanced discussion. I thought that was just my, what appealed to me in the discussion, frankly, was that I thought that was a pretty big pro to AC programs, just my own opinion, just in terms of being able to get started, you know, right away. I mean, having gone through a traditional program, you know, it wasn't until I spent my first year in the classroom that I thought, wow, I'm really getting my training here. And to have been able to get, you know, paid for that would have been, I mean, and then the alternative program would have been very appealing. And in some ways you're getting a different, in my opinion, different type of training in some of these AC programs. I mean, obviously, you know, prior studies have showed that TFA's program is vastly different than some of these university-based programs, just in terms of concentrating on things like classroom management, for instance, is huge.
All right. Good stuff. Thank you, Amber. And I think this is on the whole extremely encouraging. Not, I feel that there was a phase there where we had a sense that nothing was working, especially in education reform. Let us remind us, this is an education reform that has worked, at least to diversify the profession. And that's no small thing.
Right.
All right. That is all the time we've got for this week. So until next week.
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. Signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.